This is Carl Etnayer. I organize a speaker series at the Capital City Grange located in Berlin, Vermont. On Saturday, May 2nd, 2020, Lieutenant Governor David Zuckerman spoke there about increasing food self-sufficiency in Vermont. And by there, I mean under the auspices of the Capital City Grange, since the meeting was arranged on an online platform. With meat packing facilities hit hard by COVID-19 nationally, with farmers unable to get many of the immigrant workers who help tend and harvest crops, and with long-distance supply chains in general more fragile than they once were, we asked Zuckerman to talk about food security and self-sufficiency. At the beginning of the talk, Zuckerman fooled around with his online name, first calling himself Farmer Dave, then Lieutenant Farmer Dave. Both are references to the Heinsberg farm he and his wife run, with 15 acres of vegetables, plus chickens, hogs, and other ventures. Zuckerman began with the bigger questions of food security and food self-sufficiency before talking about ways to extend Vermont's short growing season. During the question and answer period, he again spoke to food security and self-sufficiency in Vermont and how to change our food systems. The recording begins a couple minutes into David Zuckerman's talk. He is talking about the dominance of the dairy industry in Vermont agriculture.
Can't just survive drinking 10 gallons of milk a day each. We do actually need other foods, whether it be beans, other starches. We could grow scads of sweet potatoes and storage foods, and we could can and freeze a lot of things. And we could also put up and build a lot more season extending structures, high tunnels and so forth. I don't actually see that happening at this moment in time. There's been no coordinated effort to do so. And I don't yet think there's quite the need to do so. You know, it's one thing if the meatpacking plants do shut down, and I think there is a combination there. The president can say they're essential forms of business. I don't know that he can truly say you must go to work and do the work of slaughtering animals and processing animals. I don't think we have a martial law situation just yet where people would be forced to do that. On the other hand, naming them as essential, just as we've named our stores as essential and others, allows them to be open. And in some ways, he may be forcing the business owners to have them open. Of course, the business owners aren't the ones on the cutting floor, feet apart from each other, exposed in these, from a COVID perspective, healthy work conditions, and certainly historically not from a healthy remuneration perspective. And that's something that has been true for a long time, and it's not a new phenomenon at this moment. So, I do think this conversation about COVID-19, the ramifications of what it's done to our society, the fact that we are discussing what is essential. I mean, it's very interesting to me that right now, frontline store clerks are essential workers when historically, your gas station attendants and your store clerks and your shelf stockers are getting minimum wage or a dollar or two over it. And now they're essential workers. Well, I thought essential would mean you'd get paid commensurately. And obviously, historically, our economic systems have not considered them as essential as plastic surgeons and, a number of other jobs that are out there. And so I do think out of COVID, which is not what we're talking about, we're talking about food, but it is in this time that I think the context is relevant, has really brought about a lot of people's mindsets to be thinking about how has our society been working and how has it not really been working? How has it been either failing or sort of failing to prepare for the future and or what is now the present and may be the present and future for quite some time. These are things we just don't know. Now, in terms of growing and being a farmer, which I think is more of what you'd like me to talk about, but I did want to put it in some context. I am in the very, 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 very southern edge of Chittenden County, about a quarter of a mile from Addison County. And I'm a bit towards the east, not as far east as Huntington, but not right next to the lake as some places are. But I certainly have a longer season than many of you in central Vermont. Not quite Brattleboro and some of the southern valley there, but decently longer season. So currently, what we have out in the field. We direct seeded lettuce mixes and spinach and carrots and beets and some radishes over the last three weeks, I think. We did start some as early as April 5th, I think, which is quite a bit earlier than usual. I usually aim for about April 15th, but the thaw was out of the ground the frost was out of the ground. And I find a lot of those seeds, while they might germinate slowly, they will still work their way up eventually if the ground is not too cold. And, you know, when you push the season by 2 weeks earlier on the front end, you actually only harvest about 3 or 4 days earlier once we get to July. But for those of us that are in a market gardening situation where it's our livelihood, those 3 or 4 days might mean having them in for a farmer's market versus not having them in for a farmer's market. And that can mean quite a bit of economic benefit. So I push the season, but certainly those crops, the first round of them are in the ground, even a second round. We just put peas in this week. We also transplanted our onions this week. I do put those into a silver plastic. I'm going very much into agriculture mode here. I hope that's kind of part of what you're looking for. One of the things about silver plastic as opposed to black plastic, there's also red plastic out there. The different color plastics tend to do different things for the plants. And I'm not going to go into deep detail on all of them because I don't use the red one, for instance, but supposedly your tomatoes will ripen more so with the red, the reflection of the red light from underneath as well as from above. With the silver plastic on onions in particular and the alliums, it tends to thwart thrips quite a bit. And thrips are a fairly annoying pest on your onions, particularly if you want to be storing your onions for a long time, because if they get really involved in the thrips and then they in the onion tops, and then they go down and lay an egg near the tip of the onion, then when you harvest it and store it, that maggot will unfortunately shorten the life of the storage of that onion, to say the least. And so thrips, the silver plastic does really have I've just had incredible fortunate good luck with it to greatly reduce the pest pressure in my alliums. Now, the problem with it, just so you're aware, is you better go out and work in your onions with sunglasses on, because it's almost like Mylar, that silver Mylar in terms of its reflective capacity. And so it'll really not only be annoying, but actually could be quite dangerous for your eyes, because essentially you're looking down at the sun if you're at the right angle to where the sun is coming from. So we really try to do our work in our onions on gray days, and even then sometimes wearing sunglasses if it's not a dark gray day. It's also really important to transplant your onions on a moist day or with moisture coming soon, because the onion root plug is not nearly as robust a root system as a lot of other plants that have a much more hairy root system. Onions tend to have much thicker roots, but they don't have that web effect of holding on to that soil. So often when we transplant our onions, we do have them in plugs, but in the end, not a lot of the soil that they were started in goes with them. So you want to make sure you water your onions or transplant them, you know, late in the day before the, my screen just jumped around. Lots of things are happening here. But late in the day before evening, so that they have some time to really adjust overnight. And preferably the next day would be gray or that night would be raining if you can. We also have transplanted our tomatoes and actually some zucchini and summer squash into our high tunnel. I just did a little bit of nutrient-rich water addition to my zucchini and summer squash because some of them were looking a little yellow. They also were flowering quite small. One thing you can do with zucchini and summer squash, if you transplant them early, sometimes they don't grow quite as much before they start to fruit. You'll get a much better long-term fruit yield. Not that you want ungodly numbers of zucchini and summer squash, but again, I'm a farmer producing it for market, so I do want a lot of them. But I've actually pinched off the first female flowers. I even pinched off some of the first male flowers to encourage the plant to put more energy into its leaves just here at the very beginning. You do want male flowers to open before the female flowers by a few days, because that's what will start to attract your pollinators in. So I wouldn't take off all your male flowers because you do want pollinators to start coming by regularly to visit and do their job of transferring the pollen from the male to the female flowers once they do open. But just very delicately reach down in there and pinch off those first couple of female flowers if your plants are not particularly big and robust, if you're pushing it into the early part of the season. Tomatoes, we did put those into the high tunnel about 2 weeks earlier than usual. We've continued to try to find the balance between going too early and too cold of a night, even with the high tunnel, which has no augmented heat. Obviously, tomatoes and zucchini and summer squash are quite tender. There were a few nights where we actually put two layers of row cover over the zucchini and summer squash, even within the high tunnel. One night it got down to 26, according to the telephone and the, you know, people that say what the temperature is out there. But where we are, we've learned we're typically about 3 degrees colder than that. So the outdoor temperature was about 23, and a high tunnel, you know, a big, ours are 30 feet wide by 70 to 140 feet long, but they'll add maybe 4 degrees. You know, I consider 3 safely, 4 pushing it. And so we did 2 layers of row cover because they'll do, you know, 3 to 4 degrees each as well. And so we ended up, you know, with 3 layers to protect it on that 23 degree night, and 2 pairs of zucchini got burned up and the rest lived. So we were this close to losing all of them. The other thing we did in their high tunnels during these first few weeks that plants were in them, other than the day or two of transplant, we've actually tried to keep them fairly closed and get their temperatures really right up there so that the ground would get warmer and would take in more heat as a heat sink, so that on that cold night, there was a little bit more help from below to thwart the cold coming from above. So on our scale, it's a little too big to sort of put a cup of hot water, you know, or a pot of hot water next to the 3 plants or 6 plants, because we have, you know, hundreds of plants. But that is something that can be helpful. The other thing you could do, and I don't know how much, I'll go on for another 5 minutes of random chat before I answer questions, but if you have a grow space that's sheltered like a high tunnel, but it's maybe, you know, 10 feet by 20 feet, you could also run a water line in there with a regular, you know, overhead sprinkler that fans back and forth. And if you have a really cold night coming and where you are, you still might have a night below freezing and be concerned about plants inside or outside. But I'll tell you about a story from when I was farming strawberries in the Intervale in Burlington, you know, 20 odd years ago. I would go down at 3 a.m. just as it was starting to get too cold and run the sprinkler system over my strawberries, which also had a layer of row cover on them. And as the night dropped below freezing, the water was coating everything. And you've probably seen this with news stories about oranges in Florida when it gets too cold. But if you irrigate the crop from above and you cover it with water, as the water freezes, for those of you who have a chemistry background, when water freezes or changes state from solid to frozen, it actually is a very caloric intensive event, and the water releases a lot of heat. Whenever something changes from solid to liquid or liquid to gas, those state of being transitions are much, much greater amounts of energy than going from 40 degrees to 41 degrees. Slight chemistry lesson for you all. One calorie, if I've got my units right, I'm looking at 30 years back in my chemistry studies, but 1 calorie is the amount of energy it takes to change 1 milliliter of water, which is a cubic centimeter of water, 1 degree, I believe centigrade, but it might be otherwise. Thank you. But when you're transitioning from one state to another, it is many, many more times. I don't remember what the number is. I think the liquid to the gas, it's like over 100. I think solid, liquid to solid, it's in the 30 or 40 calories. But it says Mary Chernock, but I don't think that's Mary with the beard nodding back and forth. But I like that I'm getting the confirmation of my not so great memory. Anyway, the point is, as you put water over your crops, and with strawberries, we used to do this. And at first I was like, really, this isn't going to work. But I sprayed water over the row cover, which was draped over the crops. And I remember being down there from about 3 to 6 in the morning, spraying water while it dropped to 25 degrees, which, mind you, wasn't the most pleasant early morning of my life. Getting wet when it's below freezing is not great, but I did have many, many layers on. But I remember as the sun came up, I looked at this field and it was just this big coating of ice, you know, an acre of ice. And I went over to the row cover and I looked, and underneath the row cover, water was dripping onto the plants. So water was getting put on top and it was freezing, and then releasing warmth up and down. That warmth went to the bottom part, and while there was just a little bit of energy coming from underneath as well, melting and dripping water, I obviously knew that underneath the row cover it was above 32 degrees. And so I didn't lose my strawberries that year, which is good. But it is something that you can do if you have a smaller area that you can irrigate on a particularly cold night. You're going to add a good 5 degrees of protection with water if you if it's going to get cold enough that your row cover or your sheet isn't going to quite do the job. So we do have now cabbage and brassicas outside hardening off. So that, and kohlrabi are in that family, cabbage, broccoli is in that family. We've moved those out late last week so that this week they are in their starting pots, but they are now getting used to cooler evenings. Now, you know, last night wasn't particularly cool, but it's warmer or cooler than the greenhouse, which is just sort of like perfect world for plants. When you're going to transplant them, you don't want to shock them in two ways at once. You don't want plants to be put out, exposed to the cold, and uprooted and so forth. Yes, Carl, I will move to questions in a minute or two. Perfect. Carl secretly sent me a private message that I'm revealing is not so private. So you can move plants out, then they get used to the cold temperatures for 3 to 6 nights before transplanting them, because transplanting is a shock to them. Cold air is a shock to them. You kind of want to only give them one shock rather than two at the same time. So I'll even wrap it up with that, and happy to go to questions. I don't know, Carl, do you want to call on people if they sort of raise their hand and you can see them all on your screen? Or do you just want people to chime in and have it more casual?
Yeah, we do have the possibility of people raising their hand. I see Peter Kelman has his hand up in the air. So why don't we try that? And then each of you can unmute yourself to talk when you start talking.
Okay. David, can you hear me?
I can.
So one of the questions that I've had about greater food sustainability, not absolute, but greater, is what would it take, do you think, to persuade milk farmers to give up overproducing milk, which right now is, I guess, being dumped to a certain extent, and convert at least some of their land to doing the kind of operation that you've done? My experience with the dairy farmers I know is they don't think you're really farming. they don't have much respect for truck farming.
Well, I think you've tapped on a few different things there. One is just about culture, and the other is about economics. And on the culture side, I would say that, you know, Vermont has this 100-odd year dairy culture that is an identity. And I don't fit in that identity. And there's a pride in that identity. There is a multi-generational, you know, culture essentially around dairy farming being the definition of farming. And I don't think that, I don't think there's a need to change someone else's mindset about what they believe is the right kind of farming or whatnot. I'm okay with what other people think about what their farming is versus someone else's farming. When I hiked the Appalachian Trail, there was a phrase, hike your hike. You know, you don't have to tell other people how to hike their hike. You're too worried about them. Enjoy what you're doing and do what you're doing well. Now, there are consequences to dairy farming and intensive overproduction and what happens to the land. And in that way, I think there is a societal impact, and that's where you get into either politics or economics. And I think the another little side story I'll tell is when I became a member of the American Farm Bureau Federation Young Farmers and Ranchers Committee, otherwise known as the AFBFYFNR, for an acronym, enjoy that one, back in 2002 or three, I think it was, I was lucky enough to get appointed to this 16-person national committee. And I got appointed to it solely because their geographic representation, and it turns out I was the only farmer applied in the Northeast, because I'm pretty sure that the head of the American Farm Bureau Federation probably wouldn't have picked a 5-acre organic hippie farmer who is a progressive member of the legislature to be on this committee that otherwise had, you know, a 10,000 acre rice farmer and a 4,000 cow beef farmer and a 2,000 acre hay farmer from California. And, you know, when I walked into the room, you know, a lot of them looked at me like I wasn't a farmer. Who are you? And when we started talking about our operations at the second meeting, and different people were giving 15, 20 minute overviews of the farm, what they produce, who they sell it to, you know, they were talking about these huge numbers and there was pride. You know, I grow 6,000 pounds of this and 500,000 pounds of that. And, you know, and they talked about price points that they get on the commodities world. And I said, well, you know, here's what I grow. And for my sweet corn, I get, you know, 75 cents an ear and I get, you know, $9 a dozen. And it wasn't until I started talking about the numbers of what my business produced that I suddenly gained a different head look and respect from my colleagues, because they realized this is a business person, not just a hippy dippy farmer. And I think if we, and the reason I tell that story is if we really want to shift dairy agriculture from large scale commodity production, we have to shift both our purchasing habits as individual consumers, get other people to shift their purchasing habits as consumers, and make sure those farmers get paid a reasonable price for a product that if they were to produce less of it, but it was worth more, then they would do that. And I've actually promoted that for a number of years with a Vermont brand of milk, not necessarily forcing or asking everybody to go organic, because actually that would flood the markets at the moment in terms of the demand for organic milk. But we could have conventional milk and brand it as Vermont's milk and say, in order to sell your milk into this farmer producers, you have to let your cows out on pasture more, and you have to have your farm workers get paid better under better conditions. And then we could market that brand into Southern New England, where the money is, and say, if you buy this milk for $5.79 a gallon instead of $4.99 a gallon, you are supporting cleaner water, healthier animals, and better working conditions by buying Vermont branded milk. And so you connect the brand with some sort of value that at least a percentage of the consumers would want. And that's, I think, the big picture, how you have to shift a culture like that. Sorry for the long answer, but I thought about that one a lot for a long time. So I hope that makes some sense.
Okay. Okay. Thank you for that. And I'm reminded of when we talked a few weeks ago, David, you talked about presiding virtually over the Senate, and you went into Montpelier and stood in the Senate chamber to preside virtually over the Senate. And it was partly because you had a big screen there where you could see all 30 senators. And I have gone to my big screen for this so I could see everybody on here. So if it looks like I'm gazing off into the distance, I'm really not. I'm really looking at the folks here, and I see Mary's hand, and if you want to raise your hand, your physical hand, that's fine. If you want to raise your virtual hand, that's fine. Go ahead and unmute yourself and join the conversation, Mary.
Dave, a couple of years back, I carried the motion from Capital City Grange to the state Grange meeting and met with the members of the Grange Agricultural Committee. And I was impressed because there was more energy in that committee than I've ever seen at State Grange, and that's the truth. So I wonder, have you ever talked to these people about this idea?
I don't recall specifically speaking to the Grange Agricultural Committee.
Right.
So I'd welcome that opportunity, be happy to chat. I've talked about it with a number of farmers, and one of the difficulties is our dairy farming community, back to the culture of who they are, which is who they are as a broad sweeping statement. There are a bunch of individuals with different views, but with respect to shifting from a commodity product to a value-added product with some parameters, most of them think it's an unwinnable battle. The processors control everything, and there's no way the co-ops could do this. I happen to think, you know, because I'm one of those big government intrusion people, that with government support to helping underwrite the transition and help with marketing for a number of years, we could take on the dairy industry. We could develop enough consumer interest at the stores that the stores would want to put this on their shelves. Because what actually happens is the big processors actually control what goes on the shelves at the supermarkets. And you have to be able to compete with them. And Vermont is such a small state, and the co-ops are so relatively small, they don't feel they would have a bargaining edge to be able to do that. Now, as a grassroots organizer on many political issues, I've never really felt like the political system was going to do what I wanted if I tried to do it inside the building, because other political powers were bigger than mine. But traveling the state and working with people on, say, GMOs for 15 years, the grassroots interest was so strong that we built the effort to pass GMO labeling law. But I do think building farmer support and through the Grange would be great, because the Farm Bureau is still a bit conservative in terms of trying to do something new.
Yeah, we aren't talking Farm Bureau here.
I know.
And I also want to say to you that not all of these members, but several of the very big movers and shakers in this committee were women. So I'm going to talk to those people and I'll get back to you. The second thing I wanted to ask you is how can Capital City Grange, just pie in the sky here, what can we do to help bring this about? We would like to see what you're talking about, a local food system.
Huh.
How can an organization like Capital City Grange help with that objective?
Well, I think the first thing is probably not to reinvent the wheel. There are a lot of people in the state working on food systems and resilience. You know, I think there's a couple different factors here. You know, shifting the whole dairy industry is bigger than the local resilience sort of movements, because those, I think, are far more localized and they're not necessarily statewide movements. They are, I hesitate to use like an anarchistic type word, but something much more localized. And they're about communities coming together to build, you know, local food production, local food storage, local food distribution, caring for neighbors, mutual aid groups. And that's actually really been one of the silver linings of this pandemic, is seeing the incredible community efforts that have come about. I've been on a couple calls with an Upper Valley group just here east, who've been very well organized on a lot of these issues around food systems, and they're looking at it both in the short term, just caring for neighbors and mutual aid right now and checking in on seniors who are sort of homebound and scared to go out, but also they're looking at how are we using our land? What foods are we producing? Why aren't we growing more beans? Why aren't we growing more permaculture and large nut trees and things that could produce more stable long-term food sources for us, for everything from proteins to carbohydrates and otherwise? And so I would say start talking with some of these mutual aid groups, start talking with rural Vermont has a lot of folks involved as an organization that is thinking about the food system. You know, they've advocated for a lot of policies that I've worked on a lot over the years around allowing for local small on-farm processing of animals. For those of you that aren't vegetarian, you know, it's as we look at, you know, Carl mentioned at the opening, these big meat packing plants. Well, if a few of those shut down, you know, these the I don't know who heard the article on public radio a couple days ago talking about how the food system has become so efficient in normal times that it's failing us now. And I think many people in Vermont recognize that. Obviously, the interest in a local food supply system is quite extensive, and I'm appreciative of that as a farmer, but also as a member of the community. I'll give you a quick statistic about my farm, and this may or may not be at all related, but I often throw things in for people to think about. The farm that Rachel and I say, my farm, by the way, that's a wrong statement. The farm that Rachel and I own and operate with actually 5 year-round employees and 6 to 7 additional seasonal employees. So many, many people involved to make this happen. We produce a lot of food and we distribute a lot of food all summer long. And while we're doing that, we're growing crops to store for the fall so that we have something to distribute through the winter. And I'd say our peak storage is late October, early November, when sort of all the cabbage is in, most of the carrots are in. And then from then we start distributing faster than we're harvesting. We have 4 storage rooms and probably end up with about somewhere around 100,000 pounds of food in storage. And that sounds like a pretty big number. I'll add to that, that our farm, when I looked at the Vermont Farm to Plate report, in terms of our gross sales and poundage of food produced, we're in the top 5% of diversified farms in the state. You got Harlow's farm is a lot bigger. Pete's Green is a lot bigger. Intervale Community Farm is a bit bigger than we are. But there's not a lot of really, you know, Jake Gestkilder. There are some big farms out there, but most farms don't produce 15 acres of vegetables plus 1,000 chickens plus 40 hogs. That 100,000 pounds, big number, lots of food. In Chittenden County, that's less than 1 pound of food for every resident of Chittenden County for one day. So in context, we are so far from producing the amount of food that we need for the state. Now, I don't think our food system really incorporates in our numbers how many of you grow your own gardens and put up your own food. But even still, even the best of us, and I'm going to put Ann Pierce right up there as one of the best of us, but in terms of canning food and storing food and freezing food, think how much of the food you eat is something you produce in your own garden as a percentage of your day-to-day consumption. And if you especially think about it, 365 days a year, yeah, pretty small. And so we need to be thinking about that. But groups like Rural Vermont are, they've been working on policies to allow for more local production of meats, but then also more local and on-farm slaughter of those meats. Because if you don't have the facility to process the meat, or if they're all nationwide get shut down, even our small facilities in Vermont couldn't process enough meat for what Vermont eats. And I think if you think through all of these things, processing tomatoes into sauce, freezing basil into pesto, we can do it in our kitchens, but that's where I think a coordinated effort, like with the restaurants. I'm thinking off the top of my head, and then I'll go to another question. Sorry, Carl, I tend to ramble, but one of the thoughts I've had on the COVID-19 $1.25 billion from the federal government, that all has to be spent by December 31st, or we give it back to the federal government. And it can't be spent to just do things we want to do. Technically, it has to be expenses directly correlated to that are created by COVID-19. So we can't just say, let's pave a lot of roads because we want to pave roads. We can't do that. I do think, and I threw out the idea, and it seems like a lot of people were thinking of it at the same time, education is deeply dependent on broadband. So now maybe we can use this money to put in broadband across the state to the third of the state that has terrible reception, because we have, you know, the Brigham decision on equal education would say we have to fund broadband to everybody because we don't have equal education. Great. Okay. Well, there's $150 to $200 million if we have enough people to put down the line or up the line or whatever. But similarly, what if an idea I had was, what if everybody's growing these, you know, quote, victory gardens this year, expanding their gardens, doubling their area that they're growing food on? Probably most people don't have the capacity to then, or the knowledge to can or freeze or store that food. But if we have restaurants that can't operate because of the rules around COVID-19, and they've all got larger scale kitchens and possibly even walk-in refrigeration for the day, what if we had everybody bring their extra 15 pounds of tomatoes every third day to a local restaurant, and we paid the local restaurant to process that into canned or frozen product, and it could be tomatoes, it could be basil, it could be, you know, lots of things. We can freeze all kinds of stuff, but we don't have the blanching pots to do it in or whatnot. And then we built or rented storage space for those foods. That would be under the auspices of an expense created because the restaurants are closed and we don't know if we're going to have food. So we're preparing food. So people could donate food that you grow to the restaurants. The restaurants could be paid to use their kitchens that are otherwise idle, which would help them pay their bills, at least their rent and some overhead costs. And then the food could be stored for either the food shelf or returned to those of you that donate some of the food in the form of canned food, et cetera. We have to think outside the box in a big, big way right now. And that's just one of many, many ideas. But I would say getting in touch with rural, to bring it back to your question, rural Vermont is very involved. I would say the mutual aid groups are very involved. There's a lot of regenerative ag groups that are talking about systems changes and resilience groups that are more than the mutual aid groups that are working towards creating a more resilient system as a whole. And I would talk to all of them about policies as well as local efforts.
Okay. Thank you for that. We've got a queue of speakers. We're going to the other Kelman, unrelated to the first Kelman, Anita Kelman with years of farming experience behind her, and then Barbara's in queue after that.
Hi. Yeah, no, Peter and I don't seem to be related. We can't find a common relative. But anyways, hey, yeah, Dave, Farmer Dave. I haven't seen you in ages. So here's the thing that I keep trying to figure out is, how do we find a way so that farmers can get paid enough money, given the work that they're doing, and that people can actually afford, ordinary people can afford to buy what's being produced locally? Because, you know, I know, like, if you go to, say, the farmer's market in Montpelier or whatever, you know, I know what the prices are like. You know, Farmer Cat, I know what the prices are like. And I know, you know, what organic milk is like. And I see what there's some sort of like Farmers to You or something, some sort of group out there or company that's mostly sending Vermont food down to the, you know, Massachusetts and stuff. But sure. I looked at their prices and went, holy cow. So how do we find a way that ordinary people here can afford to buy good local food while farmers are still making enough money to make it worth growing?
Well, you pet a cat, you get cat hairs in your mouth. You're asking a very, very critical question, and thank you for that. Because I have advocated that we need to pay farmers better, but then there's the other side of the equation. People, I think many would if they could afford the food. And that goes to larger structural challenges of our economic system. And, you know, I'll put the LT hat back on from the farmer hat and talk about things like the minimum wage and talk about affordable housing and how we have a system. And we often have these political debates about capitalism, socialism, communism. And I think most people throw around those words, don't quite know what they all fully mean, and don't really recognize that there are blends between them, because we actually don't live at all in a pure capitalist system. And certainly in those aspects of our society that we do, they tend to come up really short from an egalitarian and system-wide perspective. But things like raising the minimum wage, universal health care, and some of those kinds of policies would lay the groundwork for people to be in a better position where they wouldn't be as squeezed on some of those other bills to then be able to use their discretionary, what little income they even have or spare money they have, they would have slightly more discretionary capacity to make those decisions. You know, there are, I will make a joke about myself, but when I'm talking to environmental studies classes and food classes at UVM and other institutions around the state, and I'm talking to these, you know, 18 to 20 year olds about just kind of farming and maybe even paying more for your food if you really want to do both a local sustainable side of things or an environmental decision that sometimes costs more money, it means making choices. Now, some people have more capacity to make those choices. And Anita, I do not want to underrepresent those folks that are living paycheck to paycheck, because some of those folks don't have as much of a choice as many of the rest of us. But many of the rest of us think we don't have the choice, but we do make choices that put us in that position. So my joke with these college students is about my hair. And I point out that by not cutting my hair much for the last 20 years, and when it has been cut, it's been my wife or my daughter just going off the back, I've probably saved a few $1,000s in haircuts. And the same is true with these little devices, where I finally replaced my last one after about 5 years, because the universe that these things work in wasn't being kind to it anymore, because so many things take up so much memory and whatnot. And so I replaced this, but I'm going to hold on to it for another 5 years if I can help it. And, you know, there are folks that replace these every single year. Now, the folks living paycheck to paycheck are not replacing their phone every single year. I know that. But there are definitely people who make choices to get newer this or newer that, who could choose to wear that jacket a little bit longer or not get their hair dyed as frequently or various other things, and would have some disposable income for paying for some of that more expensive food. In turn, most of the farmers I know, ourselves as an example, we sell our food for X price. But when someone calls us for a farm share and they aren't really able to go where the price point is, we have a couple different avenues to help them. One is the farm share program with NOFA Vermont, where they pay for a quarter of the farm share and where the farm has to raise money for the other quarter of the farm share. And we have a number of members who send in a few extra bucks to help match that for the farm's portion. But we rarely raise enough money to match either the NOFA money or when the NOFA money runs out, because they max out how many shares they'll buy per farm. And we tend to donate the equivalent of probably 3, 4, 5 shares. It might be over 7 or 8 different shares by doing half of more of them, so that our shares become more viable for those people who really are on that edge. The same is true at the farmer's market when people bring farm to family coupons, which come in $3 increments. And what we tend to do is, you know, they bring up stuff, we weigh it out, and it goes, oh, that's $3.70. $3 is fine. We can do that when those that can afford to pay full price, pay full price. So I think there's a number of different factors here. Some are societal, universal health care, raising the minimum wage, building more affordable housing, and some are farm to farm.
Okay, thanks for that. Our next questioner is Barbara Burnett.
Who is not a farmer. But I eat. And I eat all organic because I'm chemically sensitive and have for over 30 years. And that's something that really I do, even though I'm on food stamps. And it can be done. Like you said, you just have to make choices. The question that I have right now, because I'm concerned about local fruit production, is in concerning grains. I know that, I understand that, what, in the 1800s, wasn't wheat a crop that was grown in northern New York? And I wondered if some of the dairy land can be things like hullless oats. I understand that that's the thing, because oats have a hull that's really, you have to have a machine to do it. So the hullless oats, I don't think that they need as much processing. But there are some shorter season and colder grains that should grow here, like rye and barley and things like that. And I'm just wondering if there's a push for anything like that. Because I know at the co-op recently, there have been, because of COVID, people have been buying the big sacks of flour. They're out of the big sacks of flour. They can, you know, they're putting some in their bulk bins, but they're not even ordering bulk anymore for people to get. And some things they just can't get. So that's a thing, like you said, like the carbohydrates. I know, actually, my therapist lives in Worcester. and they're doubling their garden, and they have a lot of potatoes. That's their carbs, but they are doubling the size. They had a big garden to begin with. So I'm just wondering if that's something that anybody's that's on their radar.
Well, there are a few farmers experimenting with wheat and others. You know, one of the challenges with wheat or other grains is you need that drier fall for harvest and to make sure you don't get a lot of molds and rots in your grain crops. Mm-hmm. And it is definitely a challenge because we are seeing, especially on the bookends of the season, more likely greater precipitation as opposed to less. So I think farms are looking into that. Some farmers, it's not an area that I have a lot of expertise in. But also you can also grow winter wheat and harvest that grain or winter wheat or winter rye and harvest that in June. So that tends to be, well, we've had such weird weather. We've had wet Mays into June and then dry July and August. Well, that's a little bit late, I think, for those winter grains. So I think folks are a little cautious about, you know, putting all their eggs into the basket. But there are folks starting to try.
Well, I know that like my therapist said, she says the potatoes are good. For me, sweet potatoes are good.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, but those kind of things, because I know climate change is one thing that's definitely happening. And it's going to be up and down and around. So that's, I don't think we really have a.
Yeah. Last I heard that was a hoax, but Allison.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
My turn?
Yeah, go ahead, Allison.
Hey, Dave. Thanks for doing this and being here. So I've been cooking for kids for the last 6 weeks because Vermont is feeding all kids under 18 for free, which is pretty amazing. And we found out this week that we have the federal funding to go through June 30th. And our state nutrition department is trying to get it extended right through the summer so that we'll be able to get what they call summer reimbursement rates, essentially $4 a lunch and $2.30 a breakfast for reimbursement for kids, for the meals, for all the meals we serve, which is great because we might be able to buy more local produce in June now than we usually can because we're going further into June. So I'm hopeful that we can buy local greens and stuff. But the other thing is that we should be encouraging all families now who have kids to apply for free and reduced lunches if they've lost any source of income, because if you get approved now for free or reduced lunch, then you will be automatically on that through September. And you will also get a special pandemic EBT card that gives you $5.50 per child per day with credit on it for buying groceries. So that's a way to, for families with kids under 18, to increase their food dollars. And we should be spreading that word in a big way. And if you want information on that, go to the Hunger Free Vermont website. They have all the letters that should be going home and all the details on that. That money is going to start coming in mid-May to families directly, but they have to be approved for free and reduced lunches. But even before that, without any application or any paperwork or any proving of anything, we are giving breakfast and lunch to kids now 7 days a week. And we're delivering it if they can't come to the schools and pick it up. And it's a pretty amazing system. And we're very lucky to be here and to have the trucks still coming. And we have plenty of flour. When yeast, I've been giving out yeast too, and flour and things like that, because we can still get 50-pound bags, no problem. So if anybody needs flour, come to Huntington and come to Brewster Pierce and I'll sell you some flour.
Well, one of the things that actually is interesting, Allison, you've just given a lot of info, and I, for those that know how to use chat in Zoom, I just put Deb Wolf, who's my chief of staff, the one staff person I get as a lieutenant governor, but she is the chief of herself, is her email, because Allison, that information would be really helpful. I will publicize that through my e-newsletter that anybody can, some of you may get it already, but you can sign up for it at ltgov.vermont.gov. And we do put out an email newsletter, usually normally it's every couple of weeks, but right now we're putting them out pretty frequently with updates. But also I do a Facebook Live Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday mornings at 10:30 with various updates of things the governor has rolled out or ways to get information. And so if you send me, Allison, if you're able to take down that email address and email me a little bit of that information, particularly around the EBT, free and reduced lunch signups right now, that would be really helpful to have. And you can put in the context that we talked today and Dave told me to send this to you so he could announce about it. And in terms of the 50-pound bags of flour, what's interesting, and I think there was a story, maybe even it was this morning, although anybody else having a hard time keeping track of what day it is? Maybe it was today, maybe it was yesterday, who knows? About a potato grower who had, 2 million potatoes or pounds of potatoes. And he basically was giving it away because his packaging was all 50-pound sacks. And that's not really the system that people are used to buying from in the stores. And all of his institutional buyers had stopped buying, although I think schools would be the one set of institutional buyers, maybe hospitals, that are still buying. But even hospitals are buying less because they've all emptied their beds out to make room. And thankfully, at least here, we didn't end up using all those beds. But the amount of food, I don't know, statistically, people may have heard this already, but statistically in this country, about 40% of the food that is consumed outside the home. So whether you're out at lunch because you're in a workplace, whether it's dining out in the evenings or, weekend brunches and breakfasts at different, diners, 40% is normally sort of institutionally produced in one way or another for us to consume. And what has been a shift in our system, which is what's thrown off everything with the efficiency that we have under our capitalist cheap food system, is all those 50-pound sacks. Those farms that put things up in 50-pound sacks don't really have a market for them. So it's great to know, Allison, that you've got 50-pound sacks of flour. We might call you because we've been going through quite a bit here. If anybody saw my Facebook post yesterday, Rachel made orange coriander bread that was just delicious. And she'll bake two or three loaves a day. And 2 days later, we've eaten them all. So we're going through a lot of flour. I think a lot of people are learning how to cook. I mean, I think there's a lot of things as we're getting near the end, Carl. I'm happy to go slightly long if other people want to stay. But people are learning how to cook food again. People are learning what really is essential in life in our sort of consumptive U.S. policy-minded social world that we're in. Obviously, in Vermont, I think we're all very lucky to have friends like many of you on this call that probably were farther down the line of this kind of thinking than maybe some other parts of our country. But we all are learning to reevaluate sort of what are those most important things. And I think food and even cooking and what that means for families or for mindfulness is growing. And so maybe we'll all start using those 50-pound sacks of flour, Allison. But that information is all very, very helpful. So please do pass it on. Thank you.
Well, if you're willing to stick around a couple more minutes, I will use the organizer's privilege to ask a final question here, seeing as no one else has their hand up. I know that farmers markets are very important to farmers, and for a while they were closed by governor's edict, and there were some rogue farmers who were distributing food anyway in Montpelier at the traditional farmers market location, but now new guidance has come out at the end of the week, and I guess farmers markets were able to be opened legally in connection with those that guidance. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that guidance and farmers markets.
Yeah, well, I'm still learning some of the details. I was advocating for farmers markets to be open, thinking in general of the fact that going through grocery stores, which are closed spaces with not necessarily dense numbers of people, but a fair number of people, certainly within the 6-foot guidance when you've got stalkers and everybody else going different directions down the aisles. I just sort of was thinking that seems a little strange. But I also vend at the Burlington Farmers Market, which, like the Montpelier Farmers Market, is quite crowded in the summertime. And I do think we have to be realistic about the fact that the density of people at a summer farmers market is sort of like the 5:30 hour at normal grocery stores in the normal time of year. And that isn't actually appropriate in this moment in time for people to be that close. So finding a balance was important. Certainly, I felt they could have indicated they were going to find that balance rather than say they're going to be closed and, oh, wait, we'll find a way to have them open. That's about vision, foresight, thinking things through. I'll leave my politics at that moment, but I think you get what I'm talking about. And I like most of the guidance, although I did learn recently, from one person who called my office and said, well, wait, why can't I sell yarn? That's an agricultural product and people use it for, you know, making clothing. And I'll throw that up the ladder and talk to Anson at the Agency of Ag about whether that can be shifted. But I also learned, for instance, that our farm selling pre-boxed product that you have to order today in advance, which I think it's reasonable. It's not going to be the cultural event that we normally have as farmers markets. On the other hand, you will still see other people at them and you'll be able to talk to them out on the sidewalk and properly distance. But it's going to be different going in and saying, here's my box, take the box, and not have that choice of which carrot and which tomato and which whatnot. But these are the shifts and adjustments we need to make. But I learned, for instance, that we're not going to be able to sell our CBD salve at the market, even though we produce it on our farm and we could put it in the same box with all the other stuff because it's not an essential item. So what is defined as essential, or whether a farm, you know, so is yarn essential or not? I don't know. CBD salve may not be essential if you're someone that just buys the ingredients and makes salve, but as a farmer, it's part of our livelihood. And actually for a lot of people, my hands are really dry from washing them 16,000 times a day. I don't wash them that frequently, but a lot. And salve at night keeps them moistened. So what is essential, what isn't? But also, if you're already picking up a box from me, whether there's salve in the box or not isn't going to change the speed with which you get the box. So there's details to be worked out. As a whole, I'm glad it's moving forward. I think in a lot of the smaller markets, I've been to the Chelsea market and I've been to the Linden markets, where the number of people is never that crowded. And in fact, often there's as many people as customers as there are vendors. And so there's sort of a one-to-one ratio and there's space between the vendors. And so the spacing is really not an issue at many markets. Down in Putney, I've been to that market. So I think outside of the like 5 or 10 big markets, Montpelier, Rutland, Brattleboro, Burlington, you know, maybe a few others, I don't know that it has to be quite so restrictive in terms of which vendors would be there. But I am not the governor and I don't make those decisions. Hint, hint.
Okay. Well, thanks for those comments. And it is about 5 minutes after six, so it's probably a good time to wrap up. I want to thank everybody who took time on a beautiful Saturday afternoon to join one more Zoom meeting, the Capital City Grange, and its fearless leader, Tim Swartz, and co-leader Mary Chernock, for helping put this together, publicize it. And the town of East Montpelier for providing this Zoom account to have this meeting on. Dave Zuckerman, Lieutenant Farmer Dave Zuckerman, is from Full Moon Farm in Hinesburg. You can find information about contacting him in the chat, I'll remind you, and you can find information in the chat about signing up for Grange Notes so you can find out more about upcoming events like this. Normally, we would conclude with a potluck and much merriment, and I guess we're all going to our separate meals now. We would invite our speaker to the potluck. Can we give you a rain check on that?
You can both give me a rain check on that. And, you know, we normally sometimes bump into someone in the dance line and say next dance. So, you know, I look forward to next dancing with many of you when we are allowed to be together dancing.
And for those who aren't getting the Grange Notes, the dances are starting up again in October, according to the schedule. They've been canceled through September and starting up again in October. So thanks so much, David Zuckerman, for joining us. Yes, yes. Thank, with fingers crossed for not having a double plague of influenza and resurging COVID-19 in October.
Great. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks. Bye-bye. Bye.